Take a network break. Grab a warm virtual donut and a hot coffee and join us for our weekly review of tech news. This week, we're talking about Cisco, Juniper, Snapchat, HPE, and more. We've got a ton of interesting stories to cover, so strap in and get comfortable. We're going to try to go through this fast. I'm Drew Conry-Murray. With me is Greg Farrow. Before we get started, thanks to our sponsors. This episode of Network Break is being brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account, go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30. This week's show is also being sponsored by Interop ITX. It's the only independent conference for technology leaders. It's taking place May 15th through the 19th in Las Vegas. Get a year's worth of objective IT education in just 1 week. Visit interopitx.com and use the promo code PacketPushers for a 20% discount. Into the news, Snap, that's the company behind the popular Snapchat messaging services, tossing a boatload of money into the cloud. Greg, what are they up to?
Oh, not just a boatload, a container ship-sized amount of money, right? So first of all, we had a piece of news saying that Snap will pay Google at least $400 million a year for the next 5 years. Now just think about that, $400 million to put their software into the Google Cloud. How many data centers will that buy you if you were to do that privately?
It seems like you get a lot.
I would think that you could have. But anyway, they've decided that for the next 5 years, using the Google makes perfect sense to them. And perhaps if you're in a company where there's a lot of boondoggling going on about they just listed on the stock exchange, and you don't want to be going to the stock exchange and saying, yeah, and yes, we're going to spend $1 billion over the next 5 years building out fixed infrastructure. So
I guess, but you know, part of this deal that struck me as strange, I mean, first of all, Snap, I think they started off in Google, so they're sort of just committing to Google as their cloud platform. But the way they inked the deal is that if they don't spend $400 million a year actually buying those services, they still have to pay $400 million.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess when you're buying, if I was on the Google side, I'd be saying, okay, we're going to need to build this much infrastructure. You're going to take so much of this infrastructure that we need a commitment from you. Because otherwise we can't build it. Like in the same way, when you build your own data centers, you are committing to consuming that asset over a 20-year period, right? But if you're Snap and your product is Snapchat, what does your future look like in 5 years?
Right. Well, that's that is actually what made me also wonder about this, because 5 years in cloud terms is like 100 years in regular time. And it seems like tying yourself so tightly to one platform just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Well, it does and it doesn't. You want to pick somebody, and Google's, you know, certainly as likely to survive as AWS or Azure. So it's really, you know, when you're making a deal that large, and Snapchat has such an enormous market. And don't forget that right now they are moving to list on the stock exchange. So they've floated an IPO and they're waiting, you know, moving through that process. So if you've been involved in, you just want to go on into the IPO, all you care about is getting your IPO away at a fair price. So you don't change anything.
Right.
You don't go in there saying, you know, oh, yes, and we've got a plan to build out X amount of data centers and we're going to buy them and build them all over the world and we're going to hire, you know, 1,000 new headcount to operate those and blah, blah, blah. That's not something the market wants to see. I would imagine this is why. But then a couple of days later, I saw this article in Fortune.com, which is Snapchat will buy $1 billion in Amazon cloud services over the next 5 years. So so $400 million a year in Google and another $200 million a year in AWS. Wow, that is like real money, you know?
I have to say, if I'm one of the VCs behind this, I have to feel a little bit, I don't know, it just seems like, oh, that's so much money and you're not actually owning anything.
Well, it's, you know, in the sense that this lets Snapchat just focus on what it does, which is make the software, right? You don't have this whole other business unit over here. I agree with that.
I totally understand the commitment to the cloud. You know, if you're a young company, you want fast scale, you want somebody else to be worried about the infrastructure. I get that. Just tying yourself up with these kind of deals, I don't understand.
I mean, I get it. But, you know, the point I think will be is that in, you know, to watch this in 5 years when the deals start to reach their end and see if they're building their own data centers.
Right.
Because that's $3 billion over 5 years that they're going to spend. It doesn't cost $3 billion to run data centers, even for a company with the scale of Snapchat. Right.
Right, it doesn't.
I could imagine that you could pretty easily pull $1 billion out of the bottom line there and be well. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely, 100%. 100%.
You know, in 3 or 4 years' time, as this contract, you start eyeing the end of this, I would expect them to be starting to move at least some of the functions into a dedicated server. I've heard lots of stories. I was chatting to people in Silicon Valley a couple of weeks ago while we were there for Network Field Day. And the stories of people quietly building data centers all over the world to just move stuff out of the cloud is just, you know, this isn't just happening every month. These people are shipping thousands of racks per week to build out private data centers for companies who, you know, need 10,000 servers in a data center or 20,000 servers. That's not Microsoft sized or Amazon sized, but it is a substantial private data center. It just seems like $3 billion over 5 years or $600 million a year just seems like an extraordinary amount of money to pay to rent infrastructure instead of building it out yourself. But Snapchat, of course, as a business is a very odd business. It's very much in competition with Facebook and, you know, Instagram and Twitter. It just doesn't make sense for them to equally start spending their business, you know, their executive management's time focusing on this sort of stuff. They need to, you know, get more subscribers, get the IPO away, blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
Makes sense for them for now, yeah.
Yeah, but I think you're right. 3-4 years' time, whoever is CFO of the company at that point is going to be looking at these deals and going, I think we can do better.
Wonder if we could do this a little bit more cost effectively. Yes. Maybe some of our standing static load could be taken up by, yeah. So that's good.
All right. In other startup news, the networking startup SnapRoute, which is no relation to Snap Incorporated, they announced they've raised $25 million in Series A funding. This money is coming from your usual Silicon Valley VCs, plus Microsoft Ventures, which is the investing arm of Microsoft, and AT&T. And what's the appeal here for these folks?
So SnapRoute has been making routing stacks or networking applications, as I'm starting to call them. Now, whether they're routing or SNMP or gRPC or some other I2RS, whatever it is that you want to use, these guys are writing the software that goes on top. And recently they announced an operating system. So they've taken a Linux distro and they're combining their apps into one. So you can either get some of their applications for free from their GitHub. And they've been very popular, very widely used. I know that I've heard all sorts of stories about Cumulus getting into them. They're working, a lot of the big mega scale data center providers are into SnapRoute. So Facebook seems to be big on what they're doing. I hear stories about Azure Cloud looking very strongly at taking on their software. And if Microsoft Ventures is investing, it might hint to you that they might have an appeal to Microsoft internally. Owning the company might be one way to be sure that they're doing what you want them to do when you're as big as Microsoft. I think this is very interesting in that it's a validation of this network applications. And I made a tweet out this week which said, why is it that we pay more for routing applications than we do for Microsoft Word? Because ultimately a BGP stack and an OSPF stack is far less complicated than your average Microsoft Word app. And really, you know, we should be paying $1,000 a device for this software instead of what we currently pay, which is $15,000 to $20,000. It just doesn't seem like the pricing is in line with the value that we're getting. Where we go into SD-WAN and we've got new stuff being developed, but, you know, BGP and OSPF were fundamentally finished 20 years ago. Paying high prices for it doesn't make sense, and this is where SnapRoute can come in and disrupt it.
Yeah, so this is part of that whole disaggregation story because you can pick the underlying hardware platform, and with SnapRoute, you can decide what routing applications, what protocols you want in the stack. You don't have to have this, you know, sort of bloated fits everyone customer base. You can customize the stack to your needs and liking, which you can see would be an appeal to the web scale folks like a Microsoft.
Yeah. And I think what they've also done with the routing stacks is they've instrumented it at every level. So instead of just having like BGP today, no visibility. The best you can do is read the database and do a show IP BGP or something and you get something from the CLI. There's no ability to see what's going on. And if you want to know if a route is in the BGP table, it's very difficult in the current situation today to actually do that meaningfully. SnapRoute put all these APIs on top of it and said, now you can poll for anything that you want to know. Whatever it is about BGP, knock yourself out, go in there and do it. So it's another part of this white box ecosystem that says, you know, there's enough money in there. You know, the big companies are over there doing big company things, but there's so much profit being generated. These other companies can come into the market and SnapRoute's continuing to prove that that theory holds true. There's nothing for me to turn away and say, you know, that small companies can exist under the wings of these big companies because there's so much money to be made just by starting small.
That's right. And I just want to note that SnapRoute, they're not the only networking startup who's getting investors outside of the usual channels. Barefoot Networks, we've talked about them before. They make programmable silicon. They've raised tens of million dollars from Google, Alibaba, Tencent, and others. Again, it's companies who are actually going to use this product saying, we want to get in on the ground floor, make sure you're stable, make sure we also have some input on how this product is going to evolve.
We've said that many times. Big companies buy into acquisitions sometimes because they want to own the product in the future or they want to use it. And sometimes they buy into startups just to track what that market's doing. And if that market really takes over, my speculation, for example, is in the SD-WAN space. Cisco's got an investment in VeloCloud because they want to see what's happening with SD-WAN. They want to be really close to that market. And if it's really taking off, they'll know, they want to have the inside track on whether they should be scaling up their commitment to that market and tracking what customers are actually buying. sometimes it's about making sure that as a big company, making sure a small company has you in mind, get someone on the board and you know what's happening with them. And sometimes it's about getting the inside track.
Right. Some more startup news. Here's a startup exit courtesy of HPE. They are buying a company called Niara. This is a little security company. They analyze user behavior, security logs, and network data so they can detect anomalous activity that may indicate some naughty behavior. And according to HPE, Niara is going to sit in the company's Aruba business unit and be integrated with ClearPass. That's a network security portfolio. And that means companies can do things like set policies to automatically trigger some kind of security response if ClearPass and Niara detect some kind of suspicious activity.
And on wireless, guess what happens all day?
That's right.
Suspicious activity.
Suspicious activity happens all the time.
That's right. So this is part of the security of improving the security of wireless. You're looking for events. You have some sort of machine learning system in the back end that looks for patterns that it knows about and then sends them out to your system so your system can react without you knowing it. This is automation, by the way, right? A security company that's automatically analyzing user behavior and logs to tell you that something's going wrong, that's automation of security. This is really a security automation play. And HP have acquired that to snap it onto the Aruba product.
It also reminds me of several years ago, maybe even 5 or 6 years ago. Do you remember NAC, Network Access Control, where you're supposed to do all this device detection and make sure it was met your security policies and you could remediate in real time? It seems like sort of an evolution of that.
Well, NAC never worked because the technology that sat underneath to do 802.1x required very strong support in the silicon and the software. And the vendors at the time could not make the software work, and they were unwilling to make new silicon. We've seen massive changes now. The disaggregation of the Wi-Fi market, so the silicon chips are made by one company and the software is made by another company, and they're getting massive pushes by customer to get them to be interoperable. And so there's actually been a much bigger push now to start getting into user control. And this is one way of getting into that, but automating the security. The security of wireless networks needs to be smarter in some way. It needs to be better. It has to be automatic because you can't sit there all day watching it. And attacks on wireless can happen all day. You don't need to get physical access to penetrate the network.
That's right. It's got a little bit of machine learning fairy dust sprinkled on it. And just a side note, this company, Niara, was actually founded by former Aruba VPs. So I guess it's not too surprising that they're ending up back inside Aruba. And the acquisition price was not disclosed.
That sort of thing makes it easy for them to buy. If you're ex-VP, somebody important, and your Aruba, of course, is now part of HPE, you know exactly what they did. You know why they did it. And buying them back probably gives you a cultural fit.
Exactly. You know what you're getting, pretty much.
Yeah, that's right. Whereas a lot of people who are acquired by, you know, Cisco or the HP, they're small business people. They get inside of a big company and their business doesn't go anywhere. It sort of collapses. So definitely a positive, I think.
Sticking with HPE, the company has announced that it is going to sell Mesosphere DCOS software. That's a Kubernetes competitor on HPE servers. XDX Central is reporting that HPE is also a financial backer of Mesosphere, so another relationship there. And what Mesosphere does essentially is abstracts infrastructure into resource pools for organizations who want to build private clouds.
Yeah, again, got to have one of everything. So you can't just pick a strategy and say, this is the one that we're recommending to our customers. Mesosphere is effectively a software-defined data center that's heavily based around the concept of containers or microservices. We've done several shows for it over on the Datanauts podcast. So if you're interested, go and search up on the Datanauts feed for some stuff on Mesosphere. There's some really good podcasts there that explain that if you're not familiar with it. But you would have heard of people doing Kubernetes. Well, Mesosphere is an alternative to Kubernetes that has a lot of commercial attraction for certain types of people. So now HP has decided to validate its hardware so it can sell Mesosphere to the customers that want Mesosphere.
And sticking with private cloud, Cisco and Microsoft are partnering up around Microsoft Azure Stack.
So Azure Stack, we talked about this before, it's Microsoft's software-defined data center in the same way that VxRack for VMware or their software-defined data center strategies, their vRealize and all that sort of stuff. Microsoft has been developing its own version to extend its virtualization play with Hyper-V and so forth. And the stories go that Azure Stack in particular is also meant to be an on-ramp to the Azure Cloud.
So you take Azure Stack inside your data center, build a little private cloud, and then you've also got a direct lane into Azure in the public cloud.
Yes. And the APIs are compatible to some greater or lesser degree. And, you know, tools that you build to manage your Azure, your private cloud would also be usable with the Azure public cloud. It's a hybrid cloud strategy. It's kind of like cradle to grave. So, if you're Microsoft today and you're doing Hyper-V and you think, or maybe I want to get VMware out and move to Hyper-V, this might be a way for you to do that. Now, the interesting thing about Azure Stack has been that Microsoft has said, we are only going to sell it on specific hardware. So this is another one of these things that it can't work on just any old hardware, apparently. Don't know why, but apparently. Right?
Sort of goes against the idea of private cloud scale. But anyway,
I think the early launches are going to be complicated. They're not going to be for normal humans to use. You're going to have specially blessed resources. You're going to have special – I don't know why any of this is necessary. It all seems pointless to me, right? Only so far HP and EMC, Dell EMC, have been permitted to sell Azure Stack, and they've been out there knocking on customers' doors. So for Cisco to get in on the Microsoft action and produce a version of its UCS strategy for the Azure Stack gives Microsoft a leg into the customers that want to stick with their Cisco hardware and run Microsoft's cloud solution.
It makes a lot of sense, I think, for both organizations who both have, you know, sort of slightly different customer bases, and they can sell this up without a lot of overlap.
Well, I think, you know, Azure Stack is going to be a substantial market. Obviously, so many companies do use Hyper-V today or are looking for alternatives away from VMware, because VMware doesn't give you a gradual migration to Azure. And if you've chosen Azure as your cloud of the future, maybe you want something that's a bit more Azure-ish if Microsoft is your choice. But if you're VMware, you might be looking at VMware and AWS's strategy. If you're a business person, let's just put the technology aside for a minute. You might be looking at VMware software-defined data center on AWS or AWS and thinking, you know, maybe if I was VMware-centric for this stuff, I'd be going more towards the AWS side. So it's really just a case of, you know, we are sort of seeing some sort of sides being picked in this area, which is good for customers, right? They don't want a billion choices. They really want simplicity, I think.
Yes, and having a blessed platform, even though it seems a little silly, may calm some fears.
Yeah, it is funny. On one hand, we're doing disaggregation, and on another hand, we aggregate. Right?
Yeah.
We converge. So
it's true. Yeah, that's right.
It is quite difficult.
All right, some more news about Cisco. They have been reporting problems with a clock signal component across a range of products, and it's kicking up certainly a lot of dust across my social media feeds.
Yeah, because it's heinous. It's pretty grim. We've seen Cisco was the first one that came to my attention, and subsequently with some searching around the place, it turns out it's everywhere. So Synology's got one up. PFSense, I saw a tweet from Stephen Foskett saying PFSense, who makes a little physical low-cost home-based firewall, has a clock signal component issue with exactly the same words. Meraki's posted one. And we go back to the original story, which comes from the Register, and they basically just call out an Intel C2000 Atom CPU. And these Atom CPUs that Intel has produced have a major flaw. After about 12 to 18 months, they will just fail. They'll brick. It's just about guaranteed. I read an article, but unfortunately, I've lost track of the article. I wish I had have kept it, but apparently Intel in the last quarter actually revealed to the markets that it's holding a substantial amount of cash as a rectification of this issue. So to actually say to the market, you know, we have produced a faulty product and we are now holding cash and we're waiting to see how bad the impact of this will be, that's not very great. This is very, very bad. I was talking to someone this week. They've got 120 routers, Cisco routers, in the field that they have to go and rotate out. And basically, they will die sometime in the next 6 months is the broad expectation. And when I say die, I mean they just stop working. When the chip stops working, they just power's on, but nothing's there. It's dead. And that means you can't get to the flash. You can't recover the configuration. And if you're trying to rotate 120 units, you know, ship people out to site, the cost for them is phenomenal. This is like I had another customer say that actually the cost of actually replacing these units, it's actually going to be cheaper for us to just throw them out and replace them with something else. Like they're saying, you know, we had a plan for them to just be left alone. We've only just installed them. We're actually thinking we'll just throw them out, move over to one of the SD-WAN companies because that's where we want to be in 5 years. Anyway, so this is a real issue. What was interesting is that any time a vendor goes public with this, it does not mention Intel. I suggest to you that Intel is getting vendors to sign agreements to not mention their name as part of an agreement that Intel will help them fix them. So Cisco says in its thing, you know, we don't talk about who the vendor is. We're not going to publish the name of the vendor, but we're going to fix all this. So I'm betting that Intel is paying their customers to fix their problem.
Huh, that's interesting because as this story was emerging, there was definitely a lot of complaints about Cisco, and it seems they must be getting a decent amount of kickback from Intel if they're willing to take the PR heat on this and not say, really, it's not us, it's our partner here.
I think that, yes, normally you would, but I suspect that Intel's sort of, we'll give you this much money if you don't mention our name. We don't want our brand damaged. Credit to Tony Matke this week. I'll drop this into the show notes. It's not here now, but now it is. He found an actual document from the Intel website that highlights the issue. It's buried very, very deeply in the thing. System may experience inability to boot or cease or may cease interoperation. It's just one paragraph, but he did find it. So it is there.
Well, by the way.
Yes. there is a lot. It's actually pretty grim here. This is going to affect more than just Cisco. It's going to affect a lot of products because these C2000 SoCs have been a low-cost CPU that was meant to be widely deployed in home routers and small networking gear. So as I speculated last time on the show, you know, talking about did Cisco choose a cheap-out product? You know, was it badly assembled? Was it what? No, it's definitely – everything looks like the C2000. The Intel chip is just faulty. The only question I have is why are people using these cheap, low-cost Intel CPUs when they should be using grown-up ones?
Well, it's certainly not good for Intel, who is trying to position Atom as a competitor to ARM, which is doing much better in the low-power, low-cost chipset game.
The thing is, when I buy a Cisco router, I don't expect it to use a consumer CPU.
No, you shouldn't.
if I'm in a Synology or a Meraki, and these are low-cost products that are designed to, you know, or a PFSense.
More justifiable okay. There, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Cheap CPU, cheap product, fine. You know, acceptable risk, that's there. But when you're paying a $25,000 router or a $50,000 router and it's got a cheap-ass CPU in it, I do think Cisco needs to cop for some of this. And certainly the way they've reacted to some customers suggests that they are sort of aware that they've been caught flat-footed.
All right, well, we'll stick with the story as it develops. Some interesting stuff. But we have a little pause for a break from our sponsor, IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV gives you access to the most important tools you need to prepare for your IT certification. Greg, can you tell us more?
Sure. So IT Pro TV, of course, is a place where you can get access to training and information about technology. A lot of people use it to prepare for certification. I'm a bit mixed on certification, as you know. I think most of you would do better by learning a lot more about a lot more things. Certification is great for learning a lot about a specific thing, but what you need is more than that. So if you can just access courses and stream them on demand to your favorite video device, Chromecast, Roku, TV, Apple TV, Amazon Fire, whatever it is, or you can even watch them on your mobile device, right? And course topics like cybersecurity analysts or CCNA cyber ops or Cisco cybersecurity fundamentals or Microsoft Systems Center, learn all of them so that you can be stand in front of the boss and have some knowledge about all the things that are happening around you. That will really make the boss interested in you if you've got this awareness of everything that's happening around you, right? It's not just enough to say, I'm a networking person anymore. You need to be all-rounded. So if you'd go with IT Pro TV, you'll get 100-plus step-by-step virtual machine labs from Transcender and their practice exams, which is $100 worth of value. You get everything in there straight away for one low monthly subscription price and a no-hassle cancellation policy. Clients include a long list of names that you'd recognize. You know, there's lots of people out there using this service. There are premium annual memberships that normally sell for $60 a month or $570 per year, but we have a special offer for you as part of the IT Pro sponsoring the show. Try it free for 7 days and then get 30% off the lifetime when you sign up at itpro.tv/networkbreak. Use the code networkbreak30 and that'll get you $40 off a month or $400 for the whole year. Okay? Definitely worth doing. Get into IT Pro TV. It'll give you stuff to watch and learn, like to at least get familiar with it. And it's a great way to do it. Thanks to IT Pro TV for sponsoring the Network Break.
Thanks, IT Pro TV. Remember, it's itpro.tv/networkbreak with the code networkbreak30 to get that discount. Back to the news. Ars Technica, they're reporting that a pair of patents that was recently sold by HPE to a company called Plectrum are being used in lawsuits against 7 major networking companies. The patent violations are targeting products including Cisco's Catalyst 6500, Juniper's MX routers, and Facebook's Wedge switches.
Okay. Well, lawsuits. Is it going to be a thing of the future? Anyway, I did a quick read-up on these patents. Basically, the patents are related to QoS control mechanism and apparatus, where methods for utilizing QoS processing within a communications network. And another one is to do with the cache management unit, to do with relating to caching network management address or network addresses inside the silicon. Now, these seem to me to be pretty obvious things, but back in the days when 3Com was a main vendor, it wasn't, right?
So, yeah, I should say these are patents that were originally developed by 3Com, which was acquired by HPE somewhere around 7 years ago.
That's right. So they're still inside the 20-year window. I can't remember. What is it? Technology patents only have a limited lifetime.
20 years sounds right, but I'm not sure. We'll have to look it up.
I can't exactly remember. These seem to be fairly fundamental. I'm not going to hazard an opinion on the legal veracity of, you know, which way this is going to go. What I wanted to sort of bring up with you is, are lawsuits becoming the new normal for big IT companies instead of actually, like, you know, innovating?
You know, it's a cheap and easy way to try to squeeze a little bit more money out of the market, frankly.
I don't know about cheap. I think lawyers are expensive. And you look at what SnapRoute took, $25 million in funding to produce a next generation of networking software. $25 million in legal fees for this sort of patent law doesn't seem very viable to me.
So the Ars Technica article that we referenced in this story, they're speculating at the end that this company that HPE sold the patents to might be a shell company, and is there some kind of quid pro quo going on with HPE saying, hey, take these patents, maybe do this with them, and you know, we'll share a little revenue on the back end, but you take the risk, and we'll see what happens. I don't know if that's true or not. That's just speculation on the part of the article.
But, you know, you could also speculate, did HPE put the patents in play knowing that this person would go and beat up its competitors?
It's entirely possible. The thing is, the whole idea about all these patent portfolios that these companies amass is it's supposed to be like nuclear deterrence, where if you come at me with a patent portfolio, then I'm going to come at you with my patent portfolio and nobody's going to win. So it's definitely a roll of the dice here.
In the same way that Cisco versus Aristas, you know, goes backwards and forwards. There's nobody's landing serious blows on the other.
Well, Cisco Arista, you could almost see that as being sort of a personal affront on Cisco's part and having some personal pride in this. This is just straight up, I'm going to try to get some money out of you using intellectual property laws. But you know that all the other companies, Facebook, Cisco, it was Huawei and a bunch of others who are being sued. They've got their own portfolios and they've also got lawyers. And so see what happens.
It's just interesting. You know, we've pretty much in enterprise IT, the legal stuff stopped in the mid 90s, and for it to start again 20 years later seems to be, it could be a harbinger of another decade of legal bashing each other up.
No, I hope not.
That would be boring. That would make this show very boring.
That's right. We don't want to turn into a legal podcast.
No, not at all.
All right, well, we'll stop talking about law and switch to Palo Alto Networks. They recently announced 6 new firewall appliances and 3 new software-based firewalls, as well as the 8.0 version of their PAN-OS operating system. Lots of speeds and feeds, and we've got links to the press releases and product details if you are interested. What's a little more interesting is how they actually went about it. They hosted a big live event, which was streamed online, and it was emceed by Craig Ferguson. Maybe you've heard of him. He is a celebrity and former late-night talk show host.
Yeah. So I've watched a couple of these. The product announcements are pretty much what you would think, you know, bigger hardware, more features, more speed as things get up. And of course, the new version of their PAN-OS has a bunch of new features. Really, for us to talk about any of those here is pretty much covering information that you could readily get from Palo's website. But it's this live event being streamed live online, and then you can go back and watch it. I think there's something in there. What do you think? I mean, we've done so many conferences over the years, and then I'm looking at this as a way of doing product announcements, and I'm thinking this actually worked. It was very dynamic. There was a live audience. It was very much like a sitcom kind of a setup, and it was actually kind of almost entertaining.
Yeah, I think it was kind of entertaining. When you marry celebrities with technology, it tends to be a little bit cringe-inducing because there's lots of jokes about geeks and lots of jokes about how they have no idea what they're talking about, and you're kind of like, yeah. But hats off to Palo Alto for trying something different.
Yeah. So I just wonder, I guess the question I'm trying to ask here is, you know, Packet Pushers is always trying to do different types of media, different ways of bringing you data. If you do go and have a look at this Palo Alto Networks event at paloaltonetworks.com/security-event, have a look at it. Tell me what you think. Maybe email us over here at Packet Pushers and tell us, or in the Slack channel or in the IRC, and tell us what you thought about the idea and whether it was something that you'd like think could work rather than just the usual old CEO gets up and points at a board and blah, 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 a bunch of words that somebody taught him how to speak.
Right. So is this sort of a web event a valid way of getting useful information across, and do people like it?
Yes, I'd be interested to know. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, let us know. You've got ways to reach us. Some more news. An appeals court in Pennsylvania has ruled that one of the largest hospitals in the state is called UPMC. They're not liable for a data breach that exposed personal information of 67,000 employees. A class action suit was filed against UPMC in 2014, but the 3-judge panel ruled recently that UPMC did not have a legal obligation to protect their employees' information, and that included social security numbers, bank account information, and salary information.
Extraordinary, right?
It's kind of frightening.
It's like, as somebody who spent many years doing IT security, I'm just thinking of all the money that got wasted protecting people's personal information, like employees' personal information. Why did we bother?
Well, I mean, honestly, that's kind of sort of the message that the judge is saying. There's no rule that says this organization or any organization has to protect their employee information, which kind of seems like, what? I mean, I guess there isn't a rule about that, but it just seems like, I find it frightening, frankly.
Yes. Well, this is one of these things where the gap in IT, we would just assume that such data automatically and then invest many, many, many large monies in protecting all of this data. And I guess the thing to listen to, but I would like to take away from here is that not everything needs to be protected under law. By the way, your personal opinions on the matter don't count.
That's right. I mean, according to a legal analysis I read, the court is saying it's up to the state to put in a law that says, yes, you are obligated to protect employee information, and they can work out how that would work. I should be clear that it was a hospital, but it wasn't patient information that was breached, because then that would invoke, I think, some HIPAA laws. It wasn't like credit card details, which would trigger some industry rules like PCI. It was just their employees' data that got breached, and the judge said, yep, you're not responsible to protect it. There's some quotes also from the judge saying, like, these kind of things happen. It's really impossible for a company essentially to protect this with any certainty, so it's not their responsibility. I know security is very tricky, and there's no such thing as being perfectly secure. It just feels like, as an employer, you should have some kind of obligation to watch out for the people working for you.
To protect your employees' private data. It does seem extraordinary. I mean, I'm not sure what the IT angle would be, except to say, from a security point of view, the data that you're protecting, does it actually need protecting? Anyway, who knows?
All right, we'll leave that chilling bit of news there and talk about our another sponsor, Interop, Interop ITX, where tech pros go to get objective, full-stack IT education. Interop ITX is taking place May 15th through the 19th at the MGM in Las Vegas, and you can join Greg Farrow, Ethan Banks, and me for the Future of Networking Summit. This is a two-day session where we're going to take a deep dive into next-gen developments in wide area networks, data center networking, network operations, and software-defined security. And if you register for Interop ITX, you can join us for that summit. But there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on. There's hands-on workshops like the Future of Data Centers, Container Center Crash Course, the Dark Reading Cybersecurity Summit, and the Open Source IT Summit. And besides these two-day events, there's also the conference tracks, which is 3 days. They focus on security, DevOps, cloud, infrastructure, data analytics. It's all the technologies you need for a successful full-stack IT strategy. And if you want to accelerate your career, there's plenty of sessions on leadership and professional development. And of course, you can check out over 100 vendors at Interop ITX's Business Hall. We'll have an opportunity to check out what leading and emerging tech vendors have to offer. So please join us at Interop ITX this coming May. Use the promo code PacketPushers when you register, and you'll get a 20% discount off the full ticket price. We want to see you in Vegas, so go to interopitx.com and reserve your spot today.
I'm looking forward to it. We did some meetings this week. It's going to be great.
Yeah, I know you and Ethan have a lot planned, laying out some great content. We've got some guest speakers coming in. It's going to be a good time.
Yep.
Hope to see you there. Back to the news. The website Technology Review has a really fascinating story about how automation is eroding jobs on Wall Street. This is not factory work, but high finance. It's a piece about the investment bank Goldman Sachs, and the article notes that since the year 2000, the bank has gone from 600 equities traders to just 2, and they've been replaced with 200 computer engineers that support some automated trading software.
So this is actually where the people that are being replaced are being replaced with IT people. So instead of there being blah, 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 people on the trading floor yelling at each other to sell stuff, they just replace them with computer programs. But of course, as you have more computer programs, you need more technology professionals, so developers, infrastructure professionals, and so forth. And I thought what was interesting here is, although automation will reduce the number of IT jobs to some extent, equally as we see automation and human resources being automated, there'll be more IT infrastructure coming on board, and there'll be professionals who need to run that.
I know. Well, I mean, to go from 600 folks to just 200 is pretty stunning. Also, this article noted the average salary of a trader at the biggest investment banks is upwards of $500,000. So if you're eliminating 3 of those traders for 1 IT person, that is a substantial savings.
No, and probably doing us a favor, those traders are some of the most deeply unlikable people you've ever met, as a very broad strokes.
I tend not to have a lot of sympathy for Wall Street types. I do think this article was interesting because most of the time when we talk about automation, we talk about how it's going to affect sort of the blue collar industrial types, but automation is also coming all the way up the chain. You hear about what's going to happen to law and medicine and now finance. So this is real people.
Yeah, it's just this automation that's going to be roundabouts. Like, as many of our existing tasks are automated, your job is going to change. You're going to have to be smarter than the automation to survive. And these traders obviously were not. So, bye, traders. But take a lesson for yourself there. Jobs can be automated. They're talking about a large number of jobs that can be automated, but at the same time, a lot of times they create better jobs, more interesting jobs. So make sure you're planning for that in your career.
Yes, and go read the article. It's very interesting. We'll have a link in the show notes. A little news about Juniper Networks. Their co-founder, Pradeep Sindhu, he's announced that he is planning to transition from his role of CTO at Juniper to serve as CEO of a startup called Fungible. He founded it in 2015. He's going to hold the position of chief scientist at Juniper instead of CTO now. Juniper is also an investor in the startup. Sindhu is transitioning from vice chairman of the board at Juniper to the role of technical advisor.
Yeah. Can we spell spin out very quickly?
You think this is a spin out?
He founded the startup in 2015, and now he's going to work on it full time, right? But he's going to keep his role as chief scientist at Juniper. Like, that sounds like spin out in all but name.
Okay, so you think there's a little backdoor back into Juniper?
I do. I think he's, well, I also think it's, you know, he's one of these people, he's very nerdy. Did we do a podcast with him recently?
Ethan did a podcast with him on the end of Moore's Law, which is very good. So check it out. We'll include a link, yeah.
Yes. And I think he's very much engineering focused, and he actually wants to do real work instead of pushing spreadsheets around and arguing with investors. And, you know, rightly so. So he got a startup going in 2015. I think he's probably decided that the current situation at Juniper doesn't need him around, and he wants to go off and play with real toys and do some real work for change. I think that he would probably expect that if he can get whatever it is he's playing with to work, and there's no guarantees that it will. But, you know, he was raised $32.5 million in financing to make that startup start. So full stack silicon software and packaging solution that leverages standard components, protocols, and interfaces. Where'd you get that from?
Press release, yeah.
Yeah, press release. Okay, so in other words, white box. Standard components, protocols, and interfaces with full stack silicon software. That's just white box with their own software on it. So, you know, it'll be in some market. Maybe it's a security tool. Maybe it's a networking tool. I don't know. But I think that fair enough. And those of you who are Juniper watchers might want to think, if Juniper is having a difficult time and you're, you know, not having fun there, then leaving is now is a good time and see what happens to Juniper. You can go and have fun somewhere else. I mean, it's not like he needs the money.
I'm sure he doesn't. I'm sure he doesn't.
And you could also start pointing fingers, like, if Juniper's struggling to retain its technical staff, you know, maybe it's not got anything new or anything exciting happening. And so he'd rather go over there and do something exciting. But I figure he just got tired of board meetings, PR, and media, and wants to do real work. That would be my reading.
Well, we'll keep an eye on Fungible and see how it develops. All right. Our last story for this episode is coming from Cisco. They have released a traffic forecast on the growth of fixed and mobile networking. And these kind of reports are always fun because they just have some interesting numbers. So I'm going to throw a few out there. According to Cisco, by the year 2021, mobile data traffic will represent 20% of total IP traffic, which is up from 8% of total IP traffic in 2016. So that's a pretty good jump.
Yeah, I think Chicken Little always appears on these reports just about every page.
Chicken Little?
Yeah, you know, oh my God, people are using more bandwidth, more packets, more devices, more blah, blah. And I always look at it very cynically and go like, customers, you should be very worried there's going to be more use of networks and therefore you should buy more stuffs. It's very hard not to be cynical with this report.
Oh, of course. Absolutely.
But this is each year on year. It is useful data. It is definitely well-founded. It does have a good solid basis and there's no reason to believe that the data is not accurate. But the usual thing that they're trotting out at the moment is that a car will generate 4 gigabytes of data per minute. You know, what is your network going to look like? And the answer is it won't look much different because the 4 gigabytes of data is just monitoring data. It's not actually data that you're going to save somewhere. It's going to happen inside the car, right? Have you seen that one? You've seen that many times already.
I haven't actually seen that one.
Oh, it's everywhere. If you've got a self-driving car, it's going to be producing 40 gigabytes of data every minute. What does the network of the future look like? And you're going like, well, you know, just because you produce data every time the wheels goes around doesn't mean you're going to send that off to AWS in the cloud. You're just going to have a counter and send the counter, you know, the updated counter off. It's a different. Anyway, so some of this stuff is a little bit radical, but if you want to justify why you should spend loads of money on the network, get a hold of this and drop that into your Microsoft Word reports, and then you can probably justify getting some money out of the boss for a network upgrade, especially the internet. You should be planning basically to increase your internet connection by a factor of 10 every 3 years for the next 10 years.
Yeah, lots of juicy numbers about the growth of mobile devices and particularly IoT and machine-to-machine connections. Big, 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 more, 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 grow, grow, grow. We have a link to the complete report if you want to go get it and read some numbers.
I think so, yes.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
You can find me microblogging at etherealmind.com, Twittering, and also doing various other things on social media. And of course, I still write and post articles at packetpushers.net.
Very good. I'm Drew Conry Murray. I also post articles at packetpushers.net, and I'm tweeting away at @Drew_CM. Thank you to our sponsors, IT Pro TV and Interop ITX. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you enjoy the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share it with your friends. And please check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find out how to sign up for those at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.